Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 2 of Chris Chambers Noir, featuring amazing host Chris Chambers, who has written so many books and is so like noir-y and gritty and has so much to teach us. His background is insane, which you can read in the liner notes. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV. We're also blasted out on Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, and YouTube, of course, with our video version of this show. And ChrisChambersNoir.com features all of Chris's amazing books. So we are thrilled, more than thrilled, to be here today with the amazing writer, Gary Phillips. He has written so many things and knows so much about so much. So I'm going to let Chris just take this on, and we are going to have this fantastic conversation with these two amazing writers. Take it away, Sir Chris.
Thank you so much, Hope. And again, I want to welcome everybody we're broadcasting deep within occupied Washington, D.C. Hopefully, you know, no one will rappel into the windows.
Exactly.
And shut us down. And I just want to say about Gary before we start. I mean, you know, you can read the bio on the site. You can read it in Incandescent Radio. But before you talk about him as a, in terms of graphic novels and comic books, in terms of sci-fi and fantasy, and he did a wonderful collection through our mutual publisher, Peter Karloftis, at Three Rooms Press in New York. Before you talk about the pulp that he did and the collaborations we did with that, before you talk about any of that, you have to talk about how this guy is grandmaster, bar none, of crime fiction. And I mean, I put him up there. And I'm not, you know, I'm not BSing around here. I put him up there with, you know, the Grishams and the Deavers and the Laura Lippmans and the S.J. Roseannes and the, you know, the Dennis Lehanes.
God bless
That's where he is. I mean, now my mentor, George Pelicanos, I don't know if he would say Gary's reached his level yet. But we'll get George on the show and maybe we'll have a battle.
There we go.
But I mean, his output has been that amazing, and he's been an inspiration to me for years. And I just want to say, I have to bring out, now it's gonna look opposite here, but I have to bring out a blast from the past right here. We're gonna talk about this in a minute too. This came out around the time I did my first hardcover for Random House, Sympathy for the Devil. Now, he was lucky enough to put this out, you know, not when I put mine out, which was on 9/11. Okay. But, you know, but that being said, I mean, this is, you know, this goes back, you know, and this is, you know, isn't even the first in terms of his output. I also wanted to show that.
Although that was my first, having a female character as the lead character.
Right, right. And we're going to talk about that. But it was here, but you know, the interesting thing here in terms of the innovation and the characterization is that, and we're going to talk about this as well. I'm previewing everything, you know, craftily here. Is that he's been able to jump worlds here because, you know, you have Publishers Weekly saying Phillips knows the history of Black Las Vegas and serves it up with a fast moving plot. Well, therein is some allegory and some interesting advantages and disadvantages because they have to say Black Las Vegas and they have to say it was a Black crime fiction writer. And this is that subject and that subject. You know, there's a dichotomy there. And, you know, for a long time, I think Gary and I and a few of us had to, you know, try to bridge that divide. It was almost like, you know, the Colossus of Rhodes that had to stand on two different shores while the ships sailed under him, hopefully not hitting him in a vital place. And, you know, we had to do that. And what is interesting now is that both Gary and I have lived to see a day where crime fiction writers of color, and there is an organization of that, by that name, started by Kelly Garrett and Walter Mosley, Gigi Pandian,
yeah.
has created almost a tsunami of amazing work, especially women of color, who've just taken the different genres and have made it their own. So we've, you know, we lived through the bad old days, and now we're looking at the good old days, but I don't know if the good old days are good when you've got, you know, publishers shutting down and distributors shutting down, but you know, we're going to outlive that too. So that being said, Gary,
let me, folks.
Good night. We're done. We're done here. See you next week.
We're done. Thank you.
I just wanted to ask you a hard question here. And sure. The hard question is, you know, we're talking about noir. And when I talk with George Pelicanos about noir, you know, nobody has a great definition of it. Mm. But we like to talk in terms of stylized realism. And, you know, and that could, and that jumps around because you did The Killing Joke with Christa Faust, which is about Batman and the Joker.
Right.
Now, I mean, arguably there ain't nothing real about that, but the noir element enters in there. But do you think that in our present time, when I said we're broadcasting from a hidden location here, is that an impediment or a manacle in our subgenre? You know, when we have to be realistic about what's going on around us, or is it a freeing kind of a tool, something that will that frees us to really look at different issues? I'm just gonna turn that over to you.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Chris. Because you're right. Here we are, and whoever thought we would get, you know, really to this spot? I mean, really, you know, beyond Nixon, beyond Reagan, here we are. With you know, as you said, man, you know, we've got armed troops on the streets, supposedly, you know, quote unquote, helping to stamp down crime. Of course, only in blue cities and only with black mayors. Is this in fact life, you know, during wartime, or if it isn't fascism, seems pretty damn close to it. Then I think about, well, you know, people during occupied France, man, they still wrote, I can't remember the title of the film now, but I know some brave filmmakers during that time period, you know, went out and actually shot a film, you know, surreptitiously, during the occupation. There's always been voices of opposition that have risen up no matter what the regime is. So I think as long as we can still do that, before they all put us into the camps and, you know, have us digging ditches 12 hours a day. And even then, if we make it through, or some will make it through to the other side, they can write about that. They can tell those stories. So I think one thing is funny too, as we talk about this, you know, I'm doing some edits now on this heist novel of mine that's going to come out next year.
We'll talk about that too.
Yeah. From my publisher. But as I'm doing the edits, I keep, you know, you keep kind of restraining yourself to not just comment on, you know, what's currently happening, because does that date the book? Does it set it in a certain time period? And then we'll look back on this in 4 or 5 years and think, oh, how strange and how odd people were talking about that then. Now, as we enter, you know, as the supposed, you know, or maybe golden age from now. And so on the other hand, though, the shadow of this stuff is so far stretching. It's so profound. It's so deep. You can't help but have some of that leak into, you know, what you're writing. So I think somehow I try to achieve a balance, right? But to try to achieve this balance between a bit of commentary, a bit of hopefully a bit of sly commentary on where we're at now, right? But then also just trying to figure out, I still want to tell the story I want to tell.
Yeah, because I mean, for me, it's tough because I'm here in Washington.
Yes.
And, you know, and even if this last series with, you know, with street ending in Streetwise, I got to flash the work.
There you go. That's right. Always hold up the book.
It's always do that. Everybody says, it's tough because you know, even when in the first book in that series, Scavenger, the guy was on the street.
Right.
Was unhoused, was a dope fiend, was babbling to himself.
Yeah.
In second person. But there's still stuff going on around him. And in this city in particular, even if you're talking about stuff that's going on in the street, what's going on in the Congress and in the White House, it has a bearing. It's backdrop, but it has a bearing. So
that's right.
It's tough not to talk about that.
Exactly. That's right.
You know, and it, you know, then with you in L.A., now historically, I'm going to flash the other stuff here, you know, as dark as night. This takes place during, you know, the uprisings in the, in 68.
65.
That's right. First ones.
Right.
In Watts. And, you know, it's probably a little more liberating when you're writing from a historical point of view, but, you know, you're still presaging what's happening now. Now, as you said, it might even be worse because there ain't no uprisings. There ain't no fires. You know, I mean, there's a school of thought that says that these people are in these cities to provoke that.
That's
not
right.
to come in right. after the fact.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. You know, so, you know, what are your, would your work now have any kind of anchor in what had happened earlier this year when ICE and the feds and then the National Guard were, and then even the Marines were in Los Angeles?
Right. Yeah. Like I said, I think I tried to at least reference that. But maybe just like in a passing way, like it's, you know, becomes this background. So for instance, you know, in the Heist novel that I'm editing now or responding to the comments and which I think are pretty sharp from my editor, you know, I mentioned the two big fires that we had here this year, but I just say the recent fires, you know, something that where you get a bit vague, but not too specific,
right.
Or I might mention, an ICE raid, but you know, you try not to, but since the book is not really about that, it's again, it's like this weird sort of backdrop, right, to
right.
the daily life. But of course, you know, ICE has had an effect, or these ICE raids have had an effect. I mean, there's this recent study about, you know, how it's affected agriculture. Agriculture is a big thing here in California. So you can't help but have some of that stuff leaking there because you're right. It's you know, to quote Caspar Gutman, it is the coin of the realm. On the other hand, you know, we're writing, you know, it's just kind of the world you're setting up that your characters are moving through, I think.
Right.
And so I think as long as you kind of keep that in mind, you know what I mean? Because like you said, you know, listen, we're not here to give you a soapbox or give ourselves a soapbox. We're
right.
here to entertain. We're here to, you know, hopefully they'll ground these stories though in perspective of the realities that people are living through. So again, you know, you don't want to be too heavy handed, but then on the other hand, you don't want to be too, you know, Pollyannish, I guess is the word, right? Where you're just, eschewing any kind of mention of what's the reality that we face
right,
today.
Right. But I mean, in As Dark as Night, you don't do that. You're not being Pollyannish. You can't be. And you're not preaching. I mean, you're showing, you know, rather than telling. I think it probably a function also of setting. I mean, with me here in D.C.,
yes.
that's going to be a whole different situation.
Right.
You might be freer, and I get your opinion on this, you might be freer to do a little preachiness if you're telling it, say, in first person.
Yes.
Versus third person.
Right. That's true.
Would you say that's, you know, you probably get away with
it
more?
Yes. I agree with you. There's something to that because of course you're, I mean, even, but you know, even I write in close third where I'm generally speaking in the head of the main character. But as you said, I mean, as we were talking about this, you know, yes, you want your characters to have that. I mean, listen, it does make a difference. I think if you have, characters, main characters who reflect, you know, other parts of society. And that doesn't
right.
necessarily mean that they're necessarily always characters of color. You can have certainly white working class characters who, you know, who are down and what have you. And you can just have white characters in general who think about this stuff. But it does seem that, you know, you're writing about, particularly, you know, for us, if we're writing about black male characters existing in this world today, how do you not have some of that reality rub off on what you're writing? Because it just seems that's organic. And even saying that, listen, I could be writing about a black Trump supporter, but if I write about a black Trump supporter, I want to try to write that character as dimensional and as realized as I can, and not
Amen.
Just you know, not just making
yeah.
them, you know,
right, right,
rubbing
right,
their
right,
hands.
Right,
you know.
Right. You know, yeah, I mean, yeah.
Mustache twirly, but you know, you try to make them as real as you can.
Well, I mean, let me switch gears then. I mean, get a little more lighthearted here. I mean, you have characters of such depth, and it doesn't matter what the genre or subgenre is, from sci-fi to pulp, to you know, graphic novels and comic books. But let me go dig to what we're doing. You know, primarily hard boiled sort of detective fiction.
Right.
And again, I'm going back and forth, you know, with George Pelicanos on this, and he said, we kind of came to this weird kind of maxim, and I don't know whether he agrees with it or not. I mean, I just speak and he nods. So
right,
hopefully.
Right.
But, we're basically saying that, you know, PIs, it doesn't matter who they are. It could be Sam Spade. It could be Martha, you know, Katie, you know, PIs don't actually go out and grab the clues like the cops and the police procedurals or even the people in the cozies. Even the super cozies where the cat is solving the murder. The cat probably goes out and pulls in more clues. It's basically the PI is basically going out almost like a duck in a pond and paddling around the water.
That's interesting.
And the SHIT will float up to the surface.
Right.
And they'll pick at it and see what's going on.
Yeah.
Do you think that's accurate?
That's a crazy analogy you cats worked out, but I think there probably is something to that. I was going to say though, hopefully there's a few breadcrumbs, a few cracker crumbs.
Right. I didn't want to overstate it. I just want to see what you thought.
Right, in that water as well. Right. I never thought about it like that. Now, of course, I am going to have to think about it like that, but I do like that. I do like it that, you know, well, I'll say this much. I think that for me, you know, writing, when I write a PI story, you know, write One Shot Harry story, Harry is on the outside, right? He is not the cop's friend. In fact, we see the cops beat Harry.
Oh, yeah.
So Harry is not, you know, ain't like that old, it ain't that great camaraderie that, you know, Peter Gunn and Lieutenant Jacoby had, you know what I mean, in those great half hour black and whites, you know, where Gunn would just drop by, have a cup of coffee, and Jacoby, of course, would just show him the current file of whatever the hell it is that they were working, he was working on at the time.
Yeah, well, that was his Shaft too. I mean, in the book and the movie where he's sitting there bullshitting with the supposed the man, the white cop, and everybody, and they're all having coffee.
Well, exactly. So as long as I don't have to worry about doing it like that and just keep my characters on the outside and, like I said, just sort of, you know, in the pond, man, and it's a big pond, and it is though the idea that the PI or the investigator, whoever they are, they better know, you know, that from Shinola and try to figure out, well, what is pertinent out here? What is it that I need to, you know, glom onto, and what is it that I can ignore?
Right. Yeah. Because what I've seen is, gone around in circles with other people in the subgenres, is that in the police procedurals, that's a given. In the cozies, it's a given. But in PI fiction, it's kind of nebulous as to whether, you know, yes, there are breadcrumbs, but the sheer act of the PI coming into the situation versus the cops or versus the amateur sleuth, you know, jiggles things up and stuff starts to fall loose. And then I guess you see the breadcrumbs. I don't know. Right. Maybe it's a chicken and egg thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
And one reason I was asking about this is because, you know, and you've seen this development, is that in our crime fiction realm, there's been such a change to this notion of, and this could be a marketing thing for agents and publishers, of not so much mystery anymore, because that's old fashioned. It's like thrillers, suspense and thrillers. And particularly with, and I hope I don't get into trouble here, particularly with the women, domestic fiction, domestic suspense, you know, and everything's got to be twisty, and that stupid ass word propulsive. I've never heard that word outside of, you know, book critique in my life. You know, propulsive and twisty and propulsive. You know, it's almost like a mantra. And you know, it's are we old fashioned when we don't sit there and try to plot out this twist and that twist and this propulsiveness and that propulsiveness for the sake of marketing? because it doesn't seem like the PI noir kind of category is conducive to that over engineering.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, what do you see where I'm coming from with this? Well, I just wanted to see what you said.
No, I dig what you're saying, but listen, Chris, you know, as you well know, all this stuff is sort of on your mind, you know, as you're writing these stories. And I always wrestle with yes. I mean, I think about structure. I think about the pace, obviously, right?
Oh yeah. No, that's a given.
Yeah.
I'm talking a little beyond that because there seems to be an air of artificiality in this now.
Well, you don't want to get so weirdly twisty that it becomes just, you know, odd. Like, it's so funny. Now, you know, if you go back and you read the old Perry Masons or you watch the old show, you know, it was like twist upon twist and all of it was just so odd and it could become very contrived. So you really don't want that. But listen, I also do though, right? Thinking about the reveals. I think about, you know, what does the detective uncover at any given time? What does this person uncover at any given time?
Right.
And even in this heist novel, you know, it's about a professional thief, but even he gets caught up between these two forces and he's got to figure out, you know, who these people are and how do I neutralize them? Mm-hmm. So there's always that notion of, I think, keeping, you want to keep the reader a little bit on that cliffhanger, a little bit on that, what is this and who is this about? Not so much that, again, that it's so much of an artifice, but clearly enough that it keeps them involved, keeps you involved as the writer, and of course then keeps our characters involved.
So would you say it's just a question of different nomenclature in what we're doing? I mean, it's a reveal. It's, who are we going to double cross or who double crosses us?
Right.
Rather than, you know, the twistiness of, say, domestic suspense where, well, it might not be the husband who's trying to kill you or your lover. It might be your lover's ex-lover. You know, but then again, they were in a mental hospital when all this happened.
That's right.
I just wanted to get your opinion on that because it's an interesting in terms of the engineering of our different subgenres.
Well, fortunately, I've yet to get a note from my editor saying, you know, give me a twist here, or give me this, you know, left turn here. It's actually more about clarifying or simplifying some things so that you explain, you know, to the reader without being over explanatory. How is it that we got to where we're at? So I don't think it's just about the nomenclature. I think it is about, again, you know, we do our best to create these stories as organically and as, quote unquote, naturally, and understanding that writing is an artificial practice, but as naturally as you can, you know, keeping in mind, you know, the stuff that works best is the stuff that, again, is that straight line, even if the straight line is hidden, or a bit obscured at different times, as long as you kind of know what the line is, and as long as you kind of know where it is that you're taking this character, or even if you get yourself in a corner and you can get that character out of the corner, even though that might mean going back, you know, several chapters and cleaning up some stuff or rewriting some passages, I think all to the good. I mean, it's a labor, but it is the joy of the rewriting process where now, based on, you know, some notes I've gotten and based on now just sort of reading the material again, after a few months of not having read it, coming back to it, understanding, oh, where I can plant a certain Easter egg, you know, in chapter 3 and have the payoff. I mean, you know, set up and payoff, right? So if I set it up here and I pay it off in chapter 10, isn't that kind of satisfying?
Well, let me end with the mystery stuff, at least on this in terms of payoff. Mm-hmm. These other subgenres, including thrillers, and you know, you got the thriller fest. Now you see all these dudes used to be Navy SEALs, you know, right?
Right. That's so, right. Exactly.
But there's always seems to be a payoff. And in our original triad of crime fiction, which is, you know, hard boiled noir, cozies, and police procedurals, you know, the other two, there's always a payoff. But with us, there's hardly ever a truly happy ending.
Right. That's right.
You know, do we just have a different definition of payoff, or do we just not have that? I mean, you know, what's your thought?
I think real brief, obviously, or I shouldn't say obviously, but certainly the thing that I've found with the PI novel and the satisfaction with the PI novel is, you know, generally speaking, the stakes are not high, right? The stakes are very personal. The stakes are very much, you know, family, you know, within the family or within a few people, or somebody's been wronged and you're trying to, you know, get them justice, or you try to get them out from under. But it's really about the character, the push and pull with the character and the machinations of the plot, as opposed to, you know, as we know with a thriller, you know, it's, you know, the world is going to blow up unless I, you know, get to the bomb in the basement, or unless I torture this poor bastard over here to find out, you know, yeah, when the train is coming in with the bomb underneath the train and all that stuff, the atomic bomb underneath the train and all that. So, you know, that's part of it, right? So the idea is that you're not always elevating the stakes, right? The stakes are not this, but the stakes are personal. The stakes are heartfelt. The stakes are about human beings, scuffling and scraping by maybe. And maybe the PI can come in and help set a little thing, a little right to wrong, a little modicum of justice, but it ain't going to be no huge thing. It's just not the nature of the beast.
Right. Let me just go real quick then to some of the other stuff. Like, you know, for example, our collaboration here. What's your, first off, just a general thing. I mean, are you getting more or less into short stories and anthologies? Cause we actually edited this, but I mean, I did the stories for you and Gar Haywood.
That's right.
You know, and what are you thinking of editing anything, or are you thinking of contributing more, or something like that?
Yeah, I've kind of been working on another project, which, interesting enough, sort of to your point earlier, has a kind of political dimension to it. And so I won't go into it, but it's kind of an interesting project that kind of came about with a friend of mine who's a very interesting guy who has for years been, he's been a union strategist and activist, although of late he himself has fallen into novel writing, and he's written several lovely mysteries that have come from now his obsession, his fascination with what we do. And so he and I are working on this project that's sort of happening. And unabashed plug, I'm happy to say that I've written two Harry Ingram novels, right? Ash, Darkest Night, and One Shot Harry. And now my first Harry Ingram short story is in the I think it's out now digitally. I don't think the physical copies are around yet. But the November-December issue of Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine has my short story, Dr. Morbilius. And in that, but it's a Harry story.
Remember, Dr. Morbilius and the recent Ellery Queen.
That's right.
Check it out.
That's right. He's a kind of con man spiritualist, but pertinent to the story, Harry's long gone ne'er do well father shows up. So that's kind of what the story. That's how it kicks the story into gear. Oh, wait a minute! And since we're plugging, I got to give a plug to, speaking of pulp, I got to give a plug to Three Bullet Opera, which is coming out. I think it's coming out in the beginning of November from Writ Large Press. It's a novella.
I was going to ask you about, thank you for reading my mind there. Yes. No, keep going.
It's a novella featuring a new character of mine, Jackie Alvarez, but I'm not giving away much because it's on the back of the book. I'm resurrecting an old villain, actually from silent film times, but he actually originated in a book by Norbert Jacques called Dr. Mabusa.
So Dr. Mabusa, yeah.
Yeah. So Dr. Mabusa shows up, gang. So there you go.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now we got to watch out for that. Let me, when we switch gears and we do different kinds of things, like, you know, for example, this, The Darker Mask, was superheroes.
Right.
You know, what do you put on a, do you open up your dome and put in a different brain when you're writing, you know, sci-fi or fantasy or, you know, pulp? I mean, your style kind of, you know, and this isn't a critique. I mean, a negative critique. This is a good critique. Your style pretty much is the same. You know that's a Gary Phillips work. Like, you know, Quentin Tarantino work. But I mean, but do you put any, is there anything cooking up there that's a little different when you're talking about robots and monsters in space versus, somebody like, an Arctic adventurer?
Right.
I mean, let's hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question because, of course, I am the product of all those comics I've read in the past and all the comics I keep reading now, some of the sci-fi I've read and all that. And, you know, in the mix of that, then is, you know, Donald Goines and Chester Himes and what have you. So, yeah, it's always been this jumble. And I think, yeah, to the extent that certain things are heightened or pared back in a given kind of novel, right? Cult versus, let's say, crime fiction or versus the mystery novel. I think that's prevalent in my mind. But in the end, you know, listen, as you well know, man, look, we're writing these characters and it's the effect any of this stuff has. The robot smashing through the wall or ice smashing through the wall, you have to have a reaction from your character, right? Your character has to have some sense of either dread or getting their hackles up or whatever it is, fight or flight or whatever it is that they're thinking. If you can get to that, if you can get, you know, a little bit under their skin and kind of, you know, fool with that a little bit and kind of engage your reader, hopefully that way, then I think that's all to the good.
That leads me to this, and you know we're probably going to wrap up fairly soon. But I would you be willing to do another Killing Joke kind of a thing where you have an established character, established IP? And it doesn't have to be superhero related,
right?
You know, my fantasy has always been to like a thief in the night steal. Grave Digger Jones and Coffin Ed Johnson and
right.
Have all of us take a whack at it.
Exactly.
But it could be Batman and the Joker again. Do you think you would do stuff like that again if approached?
I mean, to be very mercenary about it. Yeah. If the money was right and the setup was right. I mean,
right.
Listen, I would love to get my hands on doing a Doc Savage, novel. Now, understanding that character has been revived by a big name writer they've taken that character in a direction that I'm not crazy about. I mean, it's the grandson actually, I guess, of Doc.
Right.
I'll say it this way. You know, for a while, Shane Black was, attached. I guess he wrote a Doc Savage script and he tried to get that off the ground. He had a big name attached. He had The Rock attached, for God's sake. And although recently I've read, snippets from, I guess, a podcast interview he did recently or something like this. But he talked about the character, and I thought he said some very pertinent points, which was one, you know, we're talking about a character that, speaking of IP, you know, doesn't have, even now, doesn't have IP recognition like Batman does, like Superman does, or Indiana Jones for that matter, even though Doc, you know, of course, influenced all those characters. So even with a name attached, it was, you know, it was hard to get off the ground, and understanding that the budget would have to be of a certain thing. Even he talked about, though, he would set it in the 30s. He wouldn't modernize it. And so anyway, I thought he said the right things, but as he talked about this, it's clear, well, who's going to make that? How would that come about? Just given the vagaries. So all that to say is that maybe at some point, yeah, the idea of doing another IP character, it does appeal to me. I don't mind playing in somebody else's sandbox. But you know, again, all those things have to line up.
All right. Well, let me flip the script then. I mean, you've got like Alex Segura doing Dick Tracy, which I thought was wonderful.
Right.
But he also does, you know, original characters, original kinds of superheroes or people who are acting almost like a Batman who don't have any kind of enhanced mutant or radiation enhanced skills, but are still running around, you know, in capes and doing daring do and doing. But There seems to be a problem, though, a disconnect where, the public, even if it's Doc Savage, who does not have as rich a background as Batman, it's still something that fixates in the public's mind. And so you could have a terrible, effed up Doc Savage story that people will go see, but an original thing like what Alex was doing, right before that, it might not have any traction. It might not track at all. I mean, have teachers failed? Have we writers failed? Have parents failed? Has culture failed? Why is that? When you have, because Doc Savage was an original character at one time.
Batman was
an original character at one time. Right. What is going on out there? Is it just the corporatization of everything or what?
Well, many years ago, sci-fi writer Robert Heinlein said, these stories were competing for beer money. And today it's still true. Right now, understand that today is so much different than before. When Doc came along, there was all kinds of pulp stories. You had the radio, right?
Right.
Even radio serials weren't even around until really probably about mid-30s, even to getting into the late 30s. So, for entertainment, man, for a dime originally, and then 25 cents, man, you got yourself this big, thick pulp. You had a front story that was called Novel Length, right? Which was, 50 to 60,000 words.
Right.
You had all these short stories in the back, and you had adventure pulps. Sports pulps, whatever you wanted, you can find it, right? And so that was great. And then along comes radio serials, and then eventually TV and film and blah, 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 blah. So now we've got, 24/7, we've got everything at our fingertips on our iPads or our phones, TikTok, blah, blah, blah. In the end though, right, we are still competing for beer money. We are still competing for eyes and attention. And I just think some of that, sometimes you're right. It gets subsumed. It gets hard to break out. We face that ourselves. We know as mid-list writers, how the hell do I get my book seen among, or attention for my book among all this other stuff? But sometimes it does happen. Sometimes you do roll the dice and doggone it. You make the point. It comes up in your favor and something latches on and people respond to it. And want more of it. So, and I'm not saying I'm writing or we're writing just to be popular or just to catch that wave, but it would be nice. But on the other hand, listen, I'm writing the books I want to read. So what can I do?
No, I understand. Yeah. I totally understand. Let me just go back to something personal here. Do you think that your abilities as an author influence your ability to bluff and bullshit in poker?
Ah, if only.
Well, because I have to tell you, I have talked to Reed Farrell Coleman. I've talked to, a bunch of people, and I have outlined these outrageous games that you all make up at BoucherCon and some of these things like Des Moines. That's and right. Chicago and Chase the Queen, I have never heard of in my damn life.
That's right. Baseball, night baseball. That's right.
Is this an author thing? You know, I mean,
but what's also true is, hardcore gamblers, they won't play with us because of all that bullshit.
Well, that's the flip side. There's a reason for that.
That's right. The flip side is you guys are not serious. We're just doing it to have fun. We ain't doing it to make money because
may I disagree with you? Because it seems to me, from my personal experience, that's exactly what this is for. Because you find other suckers like me coming to the table, where I might have a full house.
That's it.
Because of the game you're playing, it switches to a nothing hand.
Exactly.
Because there ain't five queens or one red two in the hand, That's it. I'm like, wait a minute.
There you go.
Where'd my $5 go?
That's it, baby. Well, you gotta pay for your education, baby. That's how it works.
I was asking that because the final kind of thoughts on things is what is the camaraderie, among, people in our genre, it seems to be something that I've really not seen before. Now I've seen the kind of the co-sanguinity and the collegiality, especially in sci-fi, romance, fantasy, and stuff like that. But the kind of teasing, fun family thing. I mean, and I have to tell you, it's a top-down thing too. It's where you have, you know, somebody like a Harlan Coben or, you know, S.J. Right. Rosen sitting there challenging me to a one-on-one. She's four right. feet tall.
Right.
Okay. I mean, you know, you don't have that at Thriller Fest where the guys writing the Navy SEAL novels and they're talking to the women who are writing the domestic suspense and they might have a drink or something like that, but there isn't that tight, you know, kind of stuff going on there. What is it about our genre? You know, and you can say noir too, because it seems to be, you know, it's even tighter, the darker stuff that we write.
Yeah.
What is it about us that creates that situation? I mean, just,
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. Yeah, that's, you know, so again, we're getting back to the chicken or the egg, right? Is it that the people who write this stuff, because they sometimes are plunging, you know, so deep into these psyches that when they come up for air, they naturally crave camaraderie and fellowship, to use the old word, you know, and the poker table affords that kind of, you know, that kind of release, and that kind of anchor, right? In these troubled seas. Or is it, you know, the other way around, these people are naturally that way, and it's only, but to release some of the inner demons that they have, it is through the writing. You know, maybe there's some, you know, middle point between those two poles, those two ways of explaining that. But yeah, I mean, listen, you can't ask for, you know, better sets of people that you run into now and then, you know, on the road and at BoucherCon.
I kind of get down about this, but then I also get tickled about this either, is that we're not really, I kind of would like to be treated like an elder statesman, but we're really not. We're just like other people doing the same thing.
Right.
But there's still a level of respect there from the younger people. And I mean younger people who are just blowing up the world now, like Sean Cosby.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Jordan Harper and people like that, and Steph Cha. Did you ever think that you would be seen as an elder statesman or as a, and I don't mean like a Methuselah mentor, but I mean as an you know, not that aspect of it. You're putting out the pasture and like, hey, you know, what you read some chapters, but I mean it. It's, did you ever think, you know, wow, here I am and, you know, I've accomplished a lot and people are actually coming up to me and saying, hey, you accomplished a lot. I
mean, yeah. Yeah. No, well, yes, yes and no, right? You kind of think, well, you want longevity, as to paraphrase, MLK, I guess longevity has its place, right? So, it's kind of nice to be, where we're at now, I think, you know, in that regard. Hopefully it doesn't mean, as you said, that, you know, we're out of ammunition, that we, hopefully there's a little bit more left there to get down on the paper and ideas that still interest, me and you and want to, you know, put that out there and fool around with this some more and have some fun and, you know, until that big day comes, baby. Yeah, just keep at it.
Hey, I mean, going back to what I asked before, I mean, I guess having fun is all we can do before it's time to go to the gulag.
But Lord have mercy. Yeah. Well, it's either the gulag here or the big gulag in the sky.
Right, right.
One or the other. Yeah.
Well, let me get this. Ask you this as we start to wrap up. What do you see next? I mean, you talked about the heist novel.
Yeah, it's called The Haul, H-A-U-L.
Okay, and who was that by?
It's coming out from my publisher from Soho Crime.
Soho Crime, okay. Good people, good people.
Good folks, good folks.
So what do you see of as next for you personally then? I mean, you know, how are you going to impart this knowledge to all these other people and you know, even if we're on the cattle park?
Right.
I mean, what is...
Well, we better leave behind those secret diaries, man. We better leave behind those memoirs, right? Or you know, I'm sure we can learn to sneak them out from the camps.
Right.
Listen, I'm gonna keep writing books. The third Once That Harry book is also in the can. I mean, it hasn't been my editor hasn't gotten to that yet. Once we get the haul done, she'll focus on that among her other titles that she works with authors with. And then, you know, I'm still hustling, you know, a comic book idea now and then. I've still got just a little toe in TV land. And so, you know, all that stuff is just, was it irons in the fire and all that?
Right.
Jive. As long as there's, you know, these projects and as long as they're kind of interest and they have different characters and have different situations and maybe, you know, different kinds of pacing and tenor to them. I think it's all good. I mean, it keeps me active, you know, it keeps the brain moving. If nothing else, even when the body's, you know, crapping out on me.
Well, that is beautiful. And that's, you know, there. So here's a noir payoff. You just got it from Garrett Phillips. One wonders will never cease. We've seen the first one ever. We're going to have to dial up Chester Himes and have it in heaven and tell them that we actually did it. Gary, I want to thank you for this. This is a great episode. And, you know, I think it's going to be a good anchor. Please share with the folks at Soho.
Absolutely.
You know, because
they
are good people and they put out some great product. I love Peter Karloftis at Three Rooms.
At Three Rooms Press. Yeah. That's right. He and Kat are great over there, man.
Now, before we cut off, I mean, this is a payoff, but it's real life noir. So there's,
right.
there's the sour and the sweet and the sweet and the sour. Give me your thoughts in maybe 2 seconds on what's going on with like Down and Out Books or with Baker and Taylor. I mean, are we, is the meteor coming? I mean, forget the Nazi memes now with the politics. We'll go to biology. Is the meteor coming and we're the dinosaurs and there's some mammals buried under there? Or what do you think on that?
You know, it's a longer discussion. Because
Right. You know, I just wanted to see if it's real off the top of your head.
Because this also comes in the heels of, as we know, Alfred Hitchcock, Ellery Queen, and I think the three sci-fi fantasy digests have all been bought by one company.
Right.
And there was much consternation is a good word.
I think Black Cat too, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. In some quarters about that. But so is it the corporatization of all this? You know, businesses fall and rise. We could spend a lot of time. I think Down and Out was a great experiment. I think they produced some wonderful books, but I also think because they never ever cracked the distribution conundrum, right? You could buy the books from Down and Out for discount, but you couldn't return them. I mean, I think that's always going to hobble you. And by the way, and yes, as we talk about the demise of Baker and Taylor as a distributor, it also reminds me, you know, things change because, for instance, in the world of comics, for years, the big distributor had been Diamond. Now, there had been a lot of complaints about Diamond because that was it. That was, if you didn't like their terms, well, go ahead, see if you can get your comics in stores any other way, you know.
Right.
And then at some point, you know, DC figures, well, we're just going to give our business this little distribution thing called Lunar, but we're gonna, you know, tell them that that's coming, and they have to ramp up, and they ramped up, and now, you know, I guess Marvel is distributed by Penguin Random House, I think.
Penguin, yeah, I think so.
So, you know. And so is it every dog has their day or is it just the nature of capitalism itself? I mean, I guess it's all that, right? And so there you have it. Now, does this mean Does this mean that Amazon is going to be a distributor? I don't know, right? I can't. I mean, it's a void, right? So, you know, there's still Ingram. There are still distributors.
Yeah.
You know, the Publishers Group West and what have you. So it's not as if books ain't going to be in circulation. I guess the question then is who gets to circulate those books? Particularly, I suppose, Baker & Taylor, because they, you know, their specialty was to the libraries. So that's not insignificant.
Yeah, the library part. Because that's our burgeoning audience still, exactly. You know, running around, you know, in the playground. So
That's right. Exactly right. Exactly.
All right, man. Well, you know what? As the dude said in Trading Places, it's a stone brew, man. You are the most righteous. I want to thank you, my guest, the amazing Gary Phillips.
It's been a blast.
Yeah, thank you, man. We're gonna be on Incandescent Radio, and then you'll see this also on my website, ChrisChambersNoir.com.
Yes.
So thank you.
Well,
and bye bye.
Yes. Whoops. And we're having candles for the Noir for Halloween, which is coming up.
Right on.
And honor you both. So we're having a great time. Thank you so much, Gary, for being on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV and Chris's amazing show. That was a fascinating conversation. And here's to safety, peace, and love.
Right on.
Thank you both. Thank you both. And thank you to all of our readers and listeners. Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of Chris Chambers Noir. Check him out, ChrisChambersNoir.com. These two writers are truly amazing. It's fascinating. And to have this conversation and get behind the scenes with them is a gift and a pleasure. So thank you both. Be well, stay well, keep up the good fight.
Thanks, y'all.